Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to be here today and to be able to talk to you about some of the things that we're interested in relation to radiation and improving the effectiveness of radiation. For those of you who don't know, radiation is used to treat cancer. The best estimates that are out there now are that about 60% of patients should have radiation at some point during the course of their illness. It's a very commonly used treatment. It's one of the three big modalities, including surgery and chemotherapy. Trying to improve the effectiveness of what we do for our patients is actually very, very important. Throughout this talk, when I talk about improving the effectiveness, I'll be talking about not just improving cure rates, improving local tumor control rates, but that also has to be done in the context of being sure that what we do doesn't make people worse. In other words, we don't want to make induced toxicity or cause more problems for patients. This is very relevant when we start talking about combining new treatment modalities with radiation, because there's always the potential to increase side effects. The general theme out there right now, the trends in the literature and the trends in the clinic, supported by work in the laboratory, are really to look at two ways of improving radiation effectiveness. One is through what's shown on the left here, which are new technology approaches that deliver radiation extremely precisely to areas of the body and to tumors without treating adjacent normal tissues, along with very precise imaging techniques of both anatomy and biology that allow us to apply these sorts of technologies. What I'm mostly going to talk about today, though, is on the right, which is the concept of actually looking at radiation, at the biologic effects of radiation, and beginning to target molecular pathways within tumors that also contribute to radiation resistance or poor response to radiation or metastasis formation, which would also cause problems for patients even if their local tumor was controlled. These actually are quite synergistic strategies, and I think they go very well together if you look at both of them together. Our belief is that by working in both domains will actually lead to improved cure rates down the road. When we talk about combining radiation treatment, and I will mention throughout the talk, or a couple of spots at least, I'll also talk about chemotherapy and combining chemotherapy with some of these new agents, because the issues in relation to radiation are very similar in many ways to the issues of combining chemotherapy with these new kinds of molecularly targeted drugs. There's several rationale or possible reasons that you might want to combine something with radiation treatment or chemotherapy to improve the therapeutic ratio or the balance, if you like, or the ratio between tumor control and cure rates and toxicity. One is that you just get additive cytotoxicity, so that if you have radiation, it kills a certain proportion of cells in the tumors. If you add in another agent, it will kill a certain proportion of the cells, and you get an additive benefit. That's usually not too exciting because you might be able to achieve the same effect simply by increasing the radiation dose. Sometimes you see super additive toxicity where the combination actually does better than just adding the two together. This is a situation that we're all striving for because it implies some sensitization of the tumor to the effects of radiation treatment, which is the sort of holy grail. You also get something called spatial cooperation, where you may, for example, be killing cells in different regions of the tumors or different population of cells that might not respond to one treatment or the other. For example, hypoxic cells are more resistant to the effects of radiation. You can add in a treatment that might actually attack the hypoxic cells preferentially, and you get sort of a nice sort of spatial cooperation happening there. The other area where spatial cooperation is talked about a lot is with respect to metastases. The radiation really is focused on the primary tumor usually, and chemotherapy or some of these other agents might, by virtue of their systemic distribution in the body, improve cure rates by going after small metastatic foci that are present but not detectable at the time the patient is diagnosed. Of course, we're looking for non-overlapping toxicities. If we simply have agents that add together in terms of their side effects, that's going to not really benefit patients because of the potential for making them worse. Finally, there's the concept of normal tissue protection. There are agents being developed, not hugely successfully yet, that actually look specifically at protecting the normal tissue and looking at that side of the therapeutic ratio component rather than actually looking at tumor control. When we think about moving forward with these things in the clinic, there's several areas that need to be considered first. because there are many, many targets that we could consider. And some of the previous speakers showed slides of molecular targets. There's literally hundreds that we might think of that could influence radiation response. And there needs to be some rationale applied to this. So we need a theoretical reason for doing what we think might work. We need, from the clinical perspective, a promising agent and a strategy. So for the most part, we want agents that have been developed and are available to us to apply. We're not in the business, at least our group isn't in the business of developing new drugs for use in this situation. We want to see some evidence of preclinical efficacy and safety, in other words, preclinical studies that support the use of these agents in the setting that we're trying to target, and relevance in human tumors. So we want to know that whatever the molecular target is that we're considering, that target is actually expressed in the tumor that we're concerned about, that there's some that we have some measure of knowing whether when we apply this agent in the setting of radiation that the target is actually doing some good for us. So we want to have biomarkers available to us that we can actually measure in patients rather than just looking at outcome. And we need to know, of course, something about clinical efficacy and safety. That's established in phase 1-2 clinical studies. We want to know something about clinical superiority relative to the existing treatments. That's something that we establish in a phase 3 clinical study. And then often the most difficult part of applying these things in the clinic is clinical adoption because of cost issues, education issues, and all the things that are going along with translating a positive phase 3 trial into generalized use. And there are many targets that we might think about with radiation. And there is evidence from studies that go back many years that there are at least four things, broadly speaking, that were basically established from empirical investigations over the years that we know influence radiation response. Things like the intrinsic radiation sensitivity of cells. This is really more directly influenced by DNA repair issues and apoptosis. Repopulation and the growth of cells during radiation, which counteracts the effects of the cell killing that we're seeing with radiation, cell cycle effects, and of course the whole issue of hypoxia and reoxygenation, which I think many people have talked about. Dick Hill spoke about yesterday, I believe, in some detail. Probably the most success we've had to date with combining any agent with radiation, any molecularly targeted agent with radiation, is the concept of epidermal growth factor receptor targeting in the setting of head and neck cancer. Epidermal growth factor are a series of receptors that are present on most cancer cells. They're stimulated by numerous ligands that, when bound, actually stimulate a variety of signaling pathways within the cell. And these signaling pathways are involved in proliferation, cell cycle regulation, survival, invasion of metastases, and, of course, angiogenesis. And these are the results of a large phase 3 randomized study. So after going all the way down through all those steps right near the end now, where men and women with head and neck cancers were randomized to receive either radiation alone or radiation plus this agent called cetuximab, which is a monoclonal antibody that targets EGFR. And this study was exciting because it produced a survival advantage in these patients without a significant increase in toxicity. There are a few things still outstanding, and this really hasn't permeated practice as much as many people would have hoped. There's really not a good biomarker here to tell us which patients are actually benefiting from the combination of drugs in this situation, and there have been price barriers to adoption and a variety of other things. So this is evolving, and it's moving forward, and it's an indication that these kinds of things can work, but there's still lots of problems with moving them forward. What I'm interested in and what our group is interested in are aspects of the tumor microenvironment that influence radiation response and patient outcome. And again, Dick talked about a lot of these issues yesterday, I think. This is a nice slide from Rob Cairns and Nick Denko. Rob was a postdoc in our lab a few years ago. Hypoxia is an important determinant of outcome with radiation treatment, as is, we believe, low pH and acidosis, although this hasn't really been assessed to the same extent in human tumors. And finally, high interstitial fluid pressure, at least in our hands, is a strong predictor of outcome in patients receiving radiation treatment. All of these link to abnormalities of the tumor vasculature, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail. The tumor vasculature in cancer evolves as a result of this process in relation to unregulated angiogenesis. Lots of people have talked about this today. Most of us are very familiar with it. it's a concept really I like to think of it as an imbalance between pro-angiogenic factors and the inhibitors of angiogenesis in tumors that lead to this upregulation, if you like, of angiogenesis in a very uncontrolled manner, so that you get these very chaotic, disorganized, inefficient vascular structures arising in tumors. And there are a number of pro-angiogenic cytokines involved in this, secreted from tumor cells, but other cells as well, that are involved in laying down basement membrane and in the recruitment and maturation of endothelial cells, as well as parasites along the length of these vessels. And there are numerous angiogenic cytokines. There are hundreds of them that we might talk about. I want to highlight just two of them here, VEGF-A and the family of platelet-derived growth factors. And the reason I'm talking about these is that when we come back to talk about targeting molecular pathways in patients that relate to angiogenesis in combination with radiation, we have drugs available to us in the clinic that will attack these two pathways. And the drugs are sufficiently mature clinically that we can actually use these in a variety of trials and studies. Drug companies are now beginning to talk to radiation oncologists about using these things in combination with radiation. So VEGF-A, just briefly, is involved in the recruitment of endothelial cell precursors, endothelial cell survival, proliferation and migration, and vascular permeability in tumors. The platelet-derived growth factor, derived growth factors, as we've heard about in some of the recent talks this morning, are involved in parasite recruitment and maturation, endothelial cell survival, recruitment of VEGF-secreting stromal cells into the interstitium of the tumor, and they also influence signaling, integrin signaling, in many of these tumors, and have been implicated in the regulation of interstitial fluid pressure. And of course, the vasculature that evolves as a result of this very chaotic process is very disorganized and chaotic, and these are examples of what you might see. There are loops and shunts, and rapid changes in vessels. There's not any suggestion with this kind of an architecture that you would see an organized flow as you might through a normal tissue vasculature. And the vessels at higher magnification show endothelial cells bridging the lumen of the vessels. They have all sorts of pores and openings and very chaotic structure. Now, angiogenesis, hypoxia, is a very important stimulus of angiogenesis, as you've heard about, but I think also it's becoming quite clear that hypoxia itself is a direct consequence of these very abnormal vessels and the vascular architecture and the poor flow within tumors. And we know that hypoxia arises in tumors because of things like fluctuating blood flow. It varies all over the place. It's not temporally stable. It arises because of irregular flow distributions in the tumors. It arises because of long intravascular path lengths for erythrocytes, so that they give up their oxygen very early on as they enter this chaotic network, and then are hypoxic for much of the rest of the transit through this network. And of course, they're not able to provide the function that they're designed to do under those circumstances. And then, of course, long diffusion distances between vessels. But all of these things are a direct consequence of this chaotic angiogenesis that happens. And hypoxia, this is just illustrated here, hypoxia may lead to angiogenesis, but these angiogenic vessels that form also probably contribute to the furthering of hypoxia, and you get this cascade forming here, in some tumors at least, that leads to the clinical and preclinical manifestations that we see. And hypoxia has many downstream effects independent of this angiogenic stimulation. That it is now known to be very important in malignant progression in these tumors, impaired DNA repair, the development of metastases, and of course radiation resistance. One of the other consequences of angiogenesis in tumors is high interstitial fluid pressure, and this arises for a number of reasons, but the basic concept, and you may talk more about this in the next lecture, but the basic concept is that the vessels and tumors are very abnormal, they're very leaky, so fluid that's in the vascular space initially will leak out into the interstitium. The interstitium, on the other hand, is very impermeable to the flow of fluid. There are normally lymphatics in the interstitium in normal tissues. These lymphatics, they may be present in tumors, but they're not functional. And so this fluid accumulates in the interstitium, distends that interstitial matrix, the space between the cells, and causes the pressure to rise. And this may be further aggravated by things like compression of the vessels as the tumor grows. It may be aggravated by hemoconcentration and clotting within the vasculature. All of these factors may contribute to high interstitial fluid pressure. So normal tissues in this plot here are operating down at this end of the scale where we have very low interstitial fluid pressure. As a function of this, the permeability ratio between the vasculature and the interstitium. And as the vasculature gets more permeable relative to the interstitium, you move to the right here. Now, that's not the whole story, because we see fluid pressures in tumors that are as high as 100 millimeters of mercury sometimes, and most capillary pressures in normal tissues are only on the order of 15 or 20 millimeters of mercury. As you move down to the right here, this pressure in the interstitium rises until it becomes roughly equal to the capillary pressure. So there are probably, to explain this difference between the pressures we see in tumors and what we see in normal tissues, there are probably substantial differences in capillary pressure in tumors as well. And this may relate to compression of the vasculature, it may relate to this hemoconcentration issue that I talked about. But overall, it probably results from this higher vascular flow resistance that is a combination of geometric effects and viscous effects. So a few years ago, we began measuring hypoxia and interstitial fluid pressure in a group of women with cervix cancer who were undergoing radical radiation treatment. And we made these measurements before they had any treatment at all. And we accrued about 106 patients to this study. We're now up to almost 300 patients in this cohort. It's certainly the largest that's around. It's the only large-scale study of interstitial fluid pressure in a human tumor. And what we found was that there was no correlation between IFP and hypoxia. In fact, there was no correlation between IFP and any of the standard clinical prognostic factors in these tumors. But what was interesting is that IFP was an independent predictor of outcome. So the higher the IFP in these tumors, the worse these women did, independent of anything else that we could actually measure in these patients. It was independent of hypoxia. You see this is a combined survival curves showing the effects of hypoxia and IFP. Not only that, it predicted local control in the pelvis. So it predicted women who were going to fail at the site of their primary tumor after radiation. It also predicted patients who were going to develop metastatic disease after they finished treatment. These results have held out now with long-term follow-up. I think the median follow-up for this cohort is about 8 years, which is long for cervix cancer. More recently, we've been treating these women with cisplatin and chemotherapy, and there are some very interesting results in relation to cisplatin, which I'm happy to talk about later. So, because we found independent effects of IFP, which is a direct manifestation of unregulated angiogenesis in tumors, and we found an effect of hypoxia, which may arise because of angiogenesis in tumors, we began to look at whether or not we should target angiogenesis in this population of patients to see if we could improve outcome. And there is a strong rationale for this. You know, we may see, just by combining the two agents, we may see cooperative or additive cell killing, as I talked about earlier. We may see a manifestation of vascular normalization, which I'm going to come back to and speak about in just a second, with improved vascular efficiency and reduced hypoxia. We may be able to reduce IFP in these tumors. It's still at this point unclear to us whether IFP has a direct effect on radiation response or whether it's simply a biomarker that we can use to predict response in the future. And lastly, radiation itself upregulates pro-angiogenic factors in tumors. So VEGF levels, for example, go up in response to radiation, and this is thought to be a means of preserving the vasculature. It's actually been implicated as a cause of radiation resistance in tumors. So if you could block that radiation-induced upregulation of some of these pro-angiogenic cytokines actually during treatment, there may actually be a beneficial effect to patients. The vascular normalization concept was popularized by Rakesh Jain's group, and Eve Boucher from that group may say something about this. But the concept basically is that normal tissues have well-organized vasculature like this. Tumor tissues are more like this, with this very chaotic structure, as we talked about. And the theory is that if you apply an angiogenesis inhibitor in a very controlled and organized manner, with careful attention to the temporal issues surrounding how this agent is applied in relation to radiation, you can get normalization of the vasculature, remodeling of the vasculature, and improved efficiency, increased blood flow, or at least more efficient blood flow with greater delivery of agents like hypoxia or drugs to these tumors. And in fact, this was first demonstrated in a model, and Eve can correct me if I'm wrong, but this was first demonstrated in a model that was sensitive to hormones, a hormone-sensitive tumor model growing in a window chamber, where they applied androgen blockade. They castrated these animals, and the loss of testosterone normally causes tumor regression. And what the group was able to demonstrate was very early induction of endothelial cell apoptosis within 24 hours of castration of these animals, well in advance of seeing any effect on the tumor cells themselves. And coincident with that endothelial cell apoptosis were reductions in levels of VEGF within these tumors, and this very nice inhibition of vascularity. Now, over time, these tumors start to grow again because they become resistant to the effects of castration, and you get a second wave of angiogenesis happening here. Other groups have demonstrated the same effect using other models, and have also demonstrated with castration that you get improved oxygen delivery and reductions in hypoxia by this point here after 18 to 24 days. So we actually were quite interested in that, and we had another cohort of men with prostate cancer. We've also measured hypoxia in about 300 men with prostate cancer, and we were able to measure hypoxia in these fellows. This is done with a needle electrode technique, and in a smaller cohort of them who had neoadjuvant hormonal therapy, we were able to measure hypoxia before and afterwards. And this is the result of this. It was published in Cancer Research last year. And overall, we saw an improvement in oxygenation in these tumors, very consistent with a vascular normalization hypothesis. This work is still ongoing to understand what's happening at the level of the vessels within these tumors and other things. But what was quite intriguing was we didn't see this in all of the patients. The blue dots here, the blue are the individual patients where there were significant improvements in oxygenation, reduced hypoxia in these patients with the hormonal maneuver. The yellow patients lined up along the line of unity, and there was actually no significant change in these guys. There was only one man of this group of 25 or so where we saw deterioration in oxygenation. So this is an interesting result. It certainly fits with the normalization hypothesis. It could be due to other things as well, which we're currently investigating. But it certainly has implications for how we might sequence hormones with radiation in this group of men. There are several large randomized studies already that have shown that if you combine hormones and radiation, you get improved outcome, but no one really knows the mechanism by which this happens. Now, in addition to hormonal therapy, it's also been shown that various direct targets of some of these pro-angiogenic cytokines, direct targeting of these pro-angiogenic cytokines, will actually have an anti-angiogenic effect. And when we think about using these in the clinic in non-hormone-sensitive tumors like cervix cancer or head and neck cancer, for example, there are two broad classes that are available to us. The first class are monoclonal antibodies to VEGF receptors, and the one that's been most commonly used is a drug called bevacizumab, which is in phase three studies, has been used in phase three studies in a number of tumor sites, typically in combination with chemotherapy. And there are studies ongoing with radiation and bevacizumab in cervix cancer and in other tumors. And the other broad approach is to target the intracellular tyrosine kinase domains of these receptors with small molecular tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And there are numerous drugs like this out there as well. Probably two of the more common ones, sorafenib and sunitinib, are available and have been used, are now approved for use in renal cell carcinoma where angiogenesis is known to be upregulated. We have chosen, for purely logistical reasons, to use sorafenib in our cervix cancer population. There's really no, in many cases, there's not much choice between these types of drugs. And there is evidence, again, this is from the Boston group, to suggest that if you take these sorts of agents, in this case, a monoclonal antibody similar to bevacizumab, and combine it with radiation, that you actually will get a synergistic effect on tumor growth delay, that it's not just additive. So this experiment was done by taking this drug, DC-101, administering it on 3 days, day zero, day three, day six, to a group of mice with bearing tumors, and then combining it with fractionated radiation treatment at different time points. And the idea was to look to see if the sequencing of these two agents made any difference to the growth delay or how effective the radiation was. So this is a control group. This is tumor growth delay. This is the drug alone. And it brings up an important point, which is that if you use these drugs alone, anti-angiogenic drugs, they typically have static effects on tumor growth. In other words, they slow down the growth of the tumor. The tumors don't expand in the same kind of way, but they don't actually lead to huge increases in long-term tumor control or cure rates in patients. So there's a real push right now to combine anti-angiogenic drugs with chemotherapy or radiation. This is the growth delay with radiation, somewhere around 12 and a half or 13 days. And then you see when they add various sequences here, produce really additive effects with no synergism, apart from this one here, where radiation was delivered after the DC-101 had been on board in the animal for a couple of days. And it's quite interesting because when the group actually looked at hypoxia within this tumor using a hypoxia marker called pyrimidazole, the maximal effect here, the maximal growth delay, this sequencing was associated with maximal reduction in hypoxia in the tumor, again suggesting that there were changes happening at the vascular level leading to improved oxygen delivery and reduced hypoxia. There are many other effects that could contribute to this, but certainly this was a very elegant study that suggested that this hypothesis could actually work with these types of agents. And it's also been shown that if you combine these sorts of agents with chemotherapy, you get the same kind of effect happening. This is a study from Duke University that looked at similar sorts of things. There are many reasons why targeting the vessels in tumors, angiogenesis, might improve chemotherapy delivery. Vascular normalization is one of them. But there's also this concept of decreasing IFP. IFP has been hypothesized to be a barrier to drug penetration from the vessels or drug transport from the vessels into the interstitium because of the lack of convection. Drugs basically move out by diffusion or they move out by convection. Those are the two main mechanisms. If the pressure outside the vessel is the same as the pressure inside the vessel, that convective gradient for transport of these drugs is lost. And so in theory, it may contribute to decreased transport of drugs out of vessels. One of the issues is that most of these cytotoxic chemotherapy agents that we're talking about move mainly by diffusion, not by convection, because they're relatively low molecular weight. So the effect this convection issue, while it's been talked about a lot in the literature, it's not entirely clear to me that this is the main mechanism by which these types of agents actually induce greater drug uptake in tumor. There's also an effect on interstitium structure and permeability and function and interstitial transport that might contribute to improved drug penetration. But in this particular study, and there are several of them out there, the folks at Duke were able to demonstrate that imatinib, which is a PDGF targeting agent, actually reduced vessel density in these tumors, also had effects on parasite coverage. SMA is a marker of parasite coverage within these tumors. And it also produced improved survival. This is a growth delay study, but reformatted to look like a survival curve, which we typically use in human tumors, an actuarial survival curve. And the endpoint here was the time for the tumor to regrow to four times its volume at time zero. And you can see that in the combined group, there were really no events happening. So it does suggest that these things do work for radiation as well, or for chemotherapy as well. So there are still many, many issues when we talk about combining this in cervix cancer. Choice of target, VEGF, PDGF, the type of agent, the dose with radiation. Do we do maximally tolerated doses or lower doses? Most studies that have combined these agents go with maximally tolerated doses because that's the cytotoxic chemotherapy model. It might not at all be the model for these kinds of biologic targeted treatments. There are issues of sequencing with radiation. How long does the drug need to be on board before you start radiation? We need to have biomarkers. We need to think about late toxicity. And we need to think about our patients and whether they're going to be able to be accepting of these studies. So as I said, we had looked at sorafenib as an agent that we were interested in. And we actually took this into our lab and looked at a couple of issues in relation to sorafenib before we started doing it in patients just to see if it was producing effects that we thought would be useful. So these are some studies that Sarah Jane Lunt did in our lab in conjunction with Dick Hill. And again, we see the reduction in vascular density. These brown staining things here for CD31 are vessels in the tumors. And after treatment with sorafenib, we see a reduction in the vascular density. We also see reductions in interstitial fluid pressure very early on. So here are the control groups, and you see that IFP is down to about 50% or less of its pretreatment value as soon as 48 hours after the start of treatment, consistent with some effect on the vasculature and angiogenesis. What we didn't see was a lot of evidence that we're seeing vascular normalization in these tumors. We see the reduction here. What we also saw when we looked histologically at these tumors was a lot of central necrosis in these tumors and a rim of viable cells around the outside of the tumors here. And so this is, goes against, in some respects, the normalization hypothesis. These cells in this rim around the outside here, when we stained with EF5, a marker of hypoxia, actually showed increased hypoxia. So instead of having less hypoxia, they actually increased. And this movie, which played when I first started and was supposed to be replaying, actually shows a dynamic CT image of one of these tumors growing in a mouse, and you can actually see this kind of rim of enhancement here around the outside and something that looks a bit more hypodense in the middle. What was very interesting, this was actually quite discouraging to us when we saw this, but when we actually started to look at the tumors themselves and look at growth delay together, we actually did see a growth delay when we combined sorafenib with fractionated radiation, despite these kinds of changes happening in the sorafenib-only studies. We didn't see this effect when we did single-agent radiation, so one single fraction in combination with these drugs didn't produce this growth delay. In fact, the tumors that were treated with sorafenib did worse. It was only with fractionated radiation, which of course is what we're using in our patients with cervix cancer. And there's at least one other study in the literature which has shown similar effects. This is a study of a mammary carcinoma growing in a mouse, and this group did actually PET imaging with fluoromycinitazole of hypoxia at various time points. And they combined radiation with another one of these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, PTK-787. It's the same kind of drug from one of the other companies, Novartis. And they similarly showed that if you just looked alone at there's the effect of radiation in the control group, here's the effect of PTK-787, the anti-angiogenic drug, you get this increase in hypoxia in these tumors. If you, however, combine radiation, fractionated radiation with this drug, you see no change in the hypoxic fraction within the tumors. And when they did the growth delay studies, very similar to our result, they found this effect of increased growth delay with fractionated radiation and the two together. So this result's very consistent with ours. It suggests that we really don't know, I think, yet what's happening at the molecular and cellular level within these tumors to explain these kinds of results. The other thing, of course, is the side effect profile. And this is an article that was in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, a very prestigious clinical journal, just back in May, and it just these folks had seen a patient where they treated with radiation or the radiation field, somebody who received palliative treatment while they were on sorafenib, and they presented very early on afterwards with a perforated gut and died actually as a consequence of this. So we have to be very, very careful about how we're combining these two together. And it comes back to the point I made earlier, new techniques for targeting radiation more precisely rather than these big fields that deliver dosed areas that we might not necessarily want it to go or need it to go to, combining these targeted approaches with using radiation with some of these new molecular approaches may have very complementary approaches to improving patient outcome. We actually did look at toxicity with sorafenib and radiation, at least acute toxicity, using a gut toxicity assay where we look at the number of surviving crypt cells after various doses of radiation, and we actually didn't see any difference between the sorafenib-treated patients here in light blue and controls here in C3H mice. This is not this is acute toxicity. It's not necessarily the late toxicity that we're most concerned about, but at least it provides some evidence that we're not going to see a huge effect. And there are late toxicity assays that we're moving forward with. So where we're at right now in the clinic is that we started a phase 1-2 study looking at radiation and sorafenib in these patients in combination with cisplatin chemotherapy, which is standard treatment. Radiation and cisplatin are standard treatment. We are in the phase 1 aspect of this study right now where we're starting to accrue patients with sorafenib at this would be a standard dose, maximally tolerated doses for most studies in combination with chemotherapy. We're starting a bit lower and moving up. The plan is to move on to a phase 2 study with radiation and platinum. What we've tried to do in the study is build in a whole pile of biomarkers so that we don't just get information about patient outcome, we get information about what's happening at a molecular and cellular level. So we're measuring oxygen, IFP. We're doing dynamic assessments of vasculature in these tumors with CT and MRI. And of course, we're getting biopsies and blood from these patients. And all of these are happening at least three time points in each patient. One of the really interesting biomarkers that we can apply in patients is dynamic contrast enhanced CT or MRI, where we actually, the concept here is, for those of you who don't know, is that we give a bolus injection of a contrast agent to the patient, which is depicted here. So it rises very fast and then decays over time as it leaves the vasculature. We then track the corresponding tumor enhancement pattern over time, and there are various models that have been proposed whereby these two functions can be combined in a manner that yields individual estimates of things like blood flow within the tumors, blood volume, extracellular, extravascular fluid volume, and vascular permeability. And we can develop spatial maps as well about how these parameters may be distributed within our tumors. This is actually a very interesting area for development, and I think is something that, from a clinical perspective, we need more work in. So these are our first two tumors that show different enhancement patterns. This is patient one and patient two. And just for those of you who don't know, this is the bladder in the front here. The patient's lying on their back with their right side and their left side, rectum back here, bladder here. This is the tumor in the center here. And this is baseline. This is after 7 days of sorafenib alone. And this is after day 21. They're still on sorafenib, but they're also getting radiation and chemotherapy. And so you see the tumor here, this enhancement pattern. By 7 days of sorafenib, you're actually starting to get a bit of a hypodense pattern in the center of the tumor here, a bit reminiscent of what we were seeing in the preclinical models with this rim of enhancement. What was very interesting, though, is that if we measured hypoxia there, and we actually did, this area was not hypoxic by our measures. The oxygen values were very uniform through that region at about 10 millimeters of mercury. So despite the fact that we're seeing apparent changes in the vasculature, it's not quite clear yet that this kind of a picture necessarily depicts necrosis. And again, here by day 21 now, you're starting to see some reduction in size of the tumor, as opposed to here with sorafenib, there was nothing. The enhancement pattern in this tumor, which is here, is quite different. We didn't see this kind of effect on vascular density or permeability changes or whatever this was depicting, blood flow or permeability here. So there is variability in response to these agents, and these biomarkers will be very important. And this is now just translating those kinds of images to maps of K-trans, which is a measure of vascular permeability, although also influenced by blood flow to these tumors. And again, you see this effect here whereby you see this apparent reduction in permeability here or in perfusion, it's not clear which, in this top tumor, the same tumor, but not much change here along the bottom. So in summary, I think that this talk, and I hope others too, have convinced you that the microenvironment in tumors is very important in terms of progression, metastasis formation, and response to radiation and chemotherapy. The abnormal microenvironment is tightly coupled to the vasculature in tumors, which arises from unregulated angiogenesis. And this, of course, suggests that if we target the vasculature, we may be able to alter this dynamic and actually have a beneficial effect on either chemotherapy or radiation treatment and improve patient outcomes. But we don't quite know, I think, yet how these interactions are occurring, what's critical in these tumors. We don't actually know for this issue of, you know, whether normalization is happening, whether hypoxia combined with radiation, this effect of fractionated radiation that I alluded to, all those issues I think still need to be sorted out, which is alluded to here. We don't know what the right drugs are. We don't know what the right molecular targets are. It's quite likely that targeting a single pathway is not going to be the answer. There is some preclinical work now that suggests that if you target VEGF and PDGF together and do it effectively, that you get really, really, you get improved effects relative to either agent alone. And we don't know the doses of these molecular agents in relation to what's been established either for single agents or in combination with chemotherapy. And the whole concept of how we sequence these things in patients still remains up in the air. And some of these topics and issues and concerns, I think, can be really aided by mathematical modeling of what is happening in these tumors and just trying to understand from a hypothesis-generating perspective what might be going on so that we can take the results of the modeling back to preclinical studies or back into the clinic and explore that with patients. It's closing that loop between the modeling and the preclinical and clinical studies that I think will lead to big results for everyone. Thank you very much.